Today we're beginning here on the top of Lamech Chedem and Aleph. Yesterday we left off discussing the issue of Bishul Akum. And with regards to Bishul Akum, the Gemara came to the conclusion that it is a din derabonon, but it is nismach al akra. Rabbanon wanted to connect it to the psukim. That led the Rabbeinu Tam to say that it was a very, very early takana gzeira, Bishul Akum, and therefore it has more stringency than patakum. We discussed the other rishonim and how they viewed that, and the differences in their positions with regards to that. The other thing that the Gemara concluded is that Bishul Akum is connected to fire. And that is, the last statement of the Gemara was, Mayim shelon yishtarnu bibriyatana yidei ha'ur, that even though you expose water to fire, that doesn't change anything about the water. The water is still the same water, whether it's heated up or it's cold. Af ochel shelon yishtanem bibriyato yidei ha'ur. So too, any food that is not changed by the fire is not under the rubric of Bishul Akum. Or said in the other way is that anything that fire affects will have a din of Bishul Akum. And we'll see right now, we're going to see the qualifications for what is considered to be changed and what is considered to be something that is within that category of Bishul Akum. But this idea that Ur, that fire is integral to Bishul Akum, does have implications if you take it at face value and very literally, which is that only cooking Ayidea Ur, only cooking through fire would be considered to be Bishul Akum, not any other way. We're going to see something like that today, later on in the daf, but that has actually modern day implications with regards to, for instance, Dunkin' Donuts. If you go to Dunkin' Donuts and you order an egg and cheese croissant, then the individual puts it into a microwave in order to heat it up. Is putting it into the microwave considered to be Bishul Akum? It's actually a machloket haposkim. The Dunkin' Donuts in Elizabeth, New Jersey, under the auspices of Rabbi Teitz, says that there's no problem because Bishul Akum is only applicable when there's a fire. Here there's no fire, there's no Bishul Akum. And on the other hand, the Dunkin' Donuts out in the five towns on Long Island, over there they have a little sign by the entranceway that says that the egg and cheese croissant is Bishul Akum. So sometimes they'll ask you, now the workers there are well trained now, they'll ask you, would you like to put on the microwave? Would you like to turn it on in order to make your egg and cheese croissant? So there you have a difference in opinion as to whether a modern day microwave, is that considered to be Bishul Akum or is that not? And it has to do with this idea, Yedea Ur. Can it be something that simulates fire and that's enough to be called Bishul Akum? Or does it literally have to be fire in order for it to be considered as Bishul Akum? And there's actually a tshuva from Negus Moshe in Orach Chaim Chelek Gimel Siman Nun Bet about microwaves. And it has an interesting comment about microwaves and things that are not cooked by Yedea Eish. It says, Vim kein be a microwave oven, tano mikrogil, shetov v'shobo kmo be'esh mamash, that cooking in there is the equivalent to, or the same, if not better, than cooking with fire. Ve'elu sheyesh lehem tanur kazeh, and some people who have them, mishtamshim bo yoter mi bishul be'esh. They use it more than actually cooking on fire. So here, Rav Moshe is actually speaking at a time where the microwaves had just come out, and they were not so popular at the time. And Rav Moshe over here in the tshuva basically predicts that the microwaves are going to be the next big thing. He says, amash lo nitpashu tanurim elu adayin, the reason that these haven't spread and become widely used is because there are not so many of them found. When they come into the market, into the mass market, everybody is going to use them, because they're even better than using a fire. He predicted basically this wave of microwaves that are going to come about. And therefore he says that you're going to have to learn from the Mishkan that this is considered to be a toladav esh and it'll be problematic. That a person who cooks in a microwave on Shabbat will be chayav for bishol b'Shabbat. Rav Moshe is speaking about bishol on Shabbat, and that bishol on a microwave will have a din, will have the same din as bishol by fire, which is one of the 39 melachot on Shabbat. Now, even though Rav Moshe says that with regards to Shabbat, you can make a distinction between Shabbat and Bishul Akum. Because by Shabbat, the issue of Bishul is not just the mechanism by which the Bishul is done, but it's also the outcome or the result of the Bishul. And we see that because even Toldot HaEsh or Toldot HaChama Atu Toldot HaEsh are considered to be problematic. So it's not only fire, but it's even derivatives of fire that are considered to be problematic, because the main goal over here is Bishul. If you can accomplish the Bishul in any way that does not include the sun, then that will be considered to be Bishul, and your Chayav on Shabbat.
By Bishul Akum, there might be a difference, which is there, by Bishul Akum, it's not about the Bishul itself or the end result of the Bishul. Because we see later on in the Gemara that even if the Jew participates in any part of the process, that eliminates the problem of Bishul Akum. The Eish is integral to this whole process, and the actual way that it's cooked also impacts. And therefore, you could see differentiating between these two cases and saying that even though by Bishul B'Shabbat, a microwave is considered to be Bishul, by Bishul Akum, it would not be considered to be Bishul Akum. Although you could also argue in the other direction that it's Bishul for both, and therefore would be problematic for both. And you can see that in the Shul Shevet Alevi, where he clearly says that microwaves are considered to be Bishul Akum, and he formulates this in the following manner. Anything that is a normal way to cook something, that is under the rubric of Bishul Akum. And the things that were excluded from Bishul Akum were smoking, salting, and pickling. Because that's not really cooking. Those are different mechanisms for making the item edible, but they're not really cooking. And therefore, he wants to say that microwaves, which are a normal way of cooking and simulate the effect of cooking, that they should be asurim, as opposed to ishun, smoking, pickling, and salting, which actually does have an afkamina because of tuna, which is that many of the tuna boats, which are subject to a large controversy in terms of tuna fish in America because of the nets and whether they separate between the tuna and the non-kosher fish. But there's also an additional item, which is that when they bring the fish onto the islands after the catches, they actually smoke the fish over there. So now if smoking the fish is considered to be Bishul Akum, then you'd have a problem with Bishul Akum by the tuna. So over here, the Shut HaLevi says that Ishun or smoking is not considered Bishul Akum. The real issue comes up in the Gemara in the Darim. The Gemara in the Darim speaks about if someone takes a neder for to not eat things that are mevushalim, whether smoked items are considered to be a part or not a part of that. The Yerushalmi says that miushan eno bichlal bishul, that smoked items are not considered to be under the category of bishul, even though in Paraklal Godol by Shabbat, there the Yerushalmi brings down that miashen is considered to be baking or cooking. But again, as we said before, you could differentiate between the din of Shabbat and the din of Bishul Akum. And that will have enough kamina with regards to these tuna fish or fish that are smoked before they are brought to market and brought into the processing centers. And that could have caused problems of Bishul Akum. And Rabbi Yosef has a large tshuva about sardines of goyim as to whether there's a problem of Bishul Akum. And he comes out the tzad het there with regards to that issue. And in the Shud City, she brings a memory of something like that, where he says, Zichroni k'lifnei ha-milchama. I remember before the war, Ra'iti b'darchei tshuva, she'edei bishul b'kitur, that cooking by smoke, dampf, v'chein b'beit charoshet, ein bo mishum bishul akum. And cooking in a factory doesn't have a din of bishul akum. And that leads to others asking the Minchot Yitzchak, Dain Yitzchak, as to whether there is a din of bishul akum in factories. Because if the whole problem is Mishum Chatnut, then if you don't know who's cooking it, and you don't have any connection to people who are cooking it, does that then eliminate the problem of Bishul Akum? And he says, there is some smach to that in the Birkei Yosef, but he says definitely by the issue of smoked items, he says that there is a large number of achronim that believe that that is okay, and there's no problem of Bishul Akum over there. And then Dayan Yitzchak was also asked about pasteurization of milk, is that considered to be a problem of Bishul Akum? So he says that there were earlier tshuvot that said it's not a problem because it's a nechal kashu chai. You can drink it in its raw state. But Dayan Yitzchak says times have changed. And nowadays nobody would eat or drink raw milk. And only after it was pasteurized would they drink milk. Although I have to be honest that when I was here in Israel more than 30 years ago, I was working on a moshav. And in the mornings when they used to bring us the milk for breakfast, that was milk that came directly from the cows before it was pasteurized. And it was literally the milk that was taken from the cows that day. And we drank raw milk without it being pasteurized. But in areas of the world where pasteurization is a absolute necessity, like in places like America, we're not allowed to serve milk or give people milk unless it is pasteurized, then maybe the situation has changed. And therefore, is there a problem when they pasteurize the milk that that's considered to be Bishul Akum? So he brings two heterim, one heter that we had mentioned earlier from the Minchot Yitzchak, which is the fact that in factories, maybe there's no din of Bishul Akum. And he also then tries to compare pasteurization to the smoking process. So it's like smoking is not considered to be Bishul Akum. He wants to suggest that pasteurization is done by pushing very hot steam into the pipes. And therefore, maybe the steam is the same as smoke, and therefore it doesn't have a din of Bishul Akum. But he does conclude, if there is a possibility of the Jew being involved in the pasteurization process in order to solve the problem, that Tavola Bracha, that would be a really great thing to do, because we're relying on many Heterim being stacked together in order to be Matir, the pasteurization is not being Bishul Akum. And Rav Menashe Klein brings something similar in the Mishnah Halachot, and he quotes of Moshe that maybe this wasn't included under the Takanat or Bishul Akum. In general, we do not extend Dinei Dirabbonon in these situations of Zerot and Takanot, and he quotes from Moshe Feinstein as well as saying something similar in order to justify the fact that pasteurization should not be considered Bishul Akum. In addition, Rav Moshe has two tshuvot about whether bagels are a problem of Bishul Akum, because the bagels are boiled before they are baked. So in terms of Pat Akum, that's the secondary stage, which is that they are now baked in the oven. The question is the original state in which they are created, is that considered to be Bishul Akum because they are boiling the bagels? Rav Moshe argues that the bagels, when they are boiled, do not become edible after that point in time. They still need to be baked. And plus, his son-in-law Rav Tendler writes back to him, he also clarifies that it's in Olel Shulchan Melachim in that state, even if it was edible. And therefore, it's not a problem of Bishul Akum. But he qualifies all of that. He says that as long as you know that they're not adding any oils or fats or other non-kosher items to the breads or the bagels, otherwise it would be problematic. And he says you can't rely on the owners to tell you that. You need a mashkiach because they don't have nemanut with regards to these items. And therefore, you can't rely on these bagel places unless there's someone checking to make sure there's no problem with Bishul Akum. If you think there's no problem with Pat Akum, there's also no problem there. The real issue is Devarim Tmeim, and there you have to have somebody making sure that there are no Devarim Tmeim being added in.
All right, so now starting on the top line of Lamed Chet Amud Aleph, Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Yitzchak Amar Rav, Kol HaNechal K'mot Shehu Chai, Ein Bo Mishum Bishulei Ovdei Koach Ramvim. Anything can be eaten in its raw state, doesn't have a din of Bishul Akum. Now that can be read in a number of ways. In its simplest form, it just means something that can be eaten raw and does not need to be cooked. That item doesn't have a din of Bishul Akum. The Rishonim over here have other formulations of it, both that are limiting and some that are more expansive. For instance, if you would take something like a carrot, which could be eaten raw and can be eaten cooked, that clearly is covered by the statement over here. On the other hand, the Meiri over here narrows the scope of this and says that it's only something that is eaten on a normal basis when it is raw. It's not something that you could eat if you pressed yourself raw. Like, for instance, if you really wanted to eat, we were once on a trip and we saw somebody next to us eating a sweet potato raw. Does that mean that now there's no Bishul Akum by sweet potato? According to the Meiri, that's not the case. It has to be something that you would normally eat raw. So that's something like a cucumber, a carrot, celery, items that people eat raw. Then if you cook them, there's no din of Bishul Akum. So that is something that will change with time and with society, in that people might in certain eras not eat raw vegetables like we know in the time of the Gemara versus now where people do eat raw vegetables. And that will have an impact on this statement of the Gemara. On the other hand, the Poskim al Shulchan Aruch bring that even if it is Nechal Chai al Yidei Davar Acher, even if it's eaten raw but using something else, meaning that by itself it would not be eaten raw, but if you put something together with it, it would be eaten raw, that is still considered to be Nechal Chai. And the Gilyan Me'arsha is even Mechadesh, that if it's Nechal Chai, Yidei Tikkun Katan, that's also considered to be Nechal Chai. There are also those who, unlike the Meiri over here, suggest that even if it's eaten Ayideh Dachak Chai, that would be okay. And we'll see that later on with eggs, possibly, that they may not have Bishul Akum according to some of the Rishonim for that reason. So here you have different formulations of what it means to be Nechal Chai. But let's just say in the most general sense, it means that something that can be eaten raw or on a regular basis is eaten raw, then if he cooks it, that's not called Bishul Akum. The Surah Matnuhachi. That was the formulation of Rav's statement in Surah, which is the city of Rav. The Pumpedita, which is where the other yeshiva and the big settlement of the Jews was in Bavel, Manuhochi. They had Rav's statement in the following manner, which is Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak, Amar Rav, Ko she'enu nechal al shulchan melachim lafeit bo et apat, ein bo mishum bishulei ovdei kochavim. Anything that is not served on the table of kings in order to accompany the pot doesn't have a din of Bishul Akum. So here again, you have the Rishonim formulating this across the board. From the Gemara itself, it sounds like that over here it requires something that is lafetet bo et apat, something that is joined together with bread. It's only put on the table in the context of a meal or a large meal with pot, but that means that if something would have been brought on the table independently, but it's not lafetet apat, then that's not considered to be olei shulchan melachim. You can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel, Rabbeinu Chananel in a minute, when we speak about the daisa, says the problem with daisa is nechal b'chai, it's eaten raw, ve'enu nechalet b'pat. It's not eaten together with bread. So his point is not that it is ola shulchan melachim alone, but it's ola shulchan melachim and melafet et apat. And it also is an accompaniment to pat. Ritva believes that that's the case, that only something that is put on the table that's melafet et apat will be considered in this manner. It's ola shulchan melachim, even if it's significant enough to be on shulchan melachim, but it's not used to melafet et apat. According to him, that would not be included in the problem of bishul akum. On the other hand, the Rashba says, lelafet bo et apat is just the way that they normally ate things, but that's not necessarily a guidepost for what's ola shulchan melachim. If it's ola shulchan melachim, it would be a problem, irrespective of whether it's a lafet bo et apat. Those that explain the shita of the Ritva say that the whole problem here, or at least part of the problem here, is mishum chatnut, is marriage or intermarriage, and that comes from a socialization, and that's only true when there's a kviat su'udah. Kviat su'udah requires lechem, and that's why they're focused on the lafet bo et apat. Whereas if it's not the lafet bo et apat, it's what's called ekrai ba'alma. It's more of a one-off thing, not something that's going to bring to socialization or bringing people together. And therefore, the definition of Shulchan Melachim is only lafet bo et apat. So here you have two different statements from Rav as to what qualifies something to be under the rubric of bishul akum. The first one says that if it's eaten in its raw state, then cooking it makes no difference. The other one says that if it's not presentable to be put on Shulchan Melachim, it doesn't have a din of bishul akum. Ma benayu. What's the nafkamina between these two reasons? Ika benayu. The difference between them is the following three items. Dagim ktanim, small fish. Ve'arde, fungus or mushrooms. Ve'daisa, which is pounded grain or some sort of porridge or farina. Here you can see in Rashi that the reason behind each of these items is Eina nechalim chayin, they're not eaten raw. Ve'en olim al shulchan melachim, but they're also not placed on the tables of the kings. Elish nakama, yesh behem mishum b'shule obdei kochavim. According to the Elish nakama, there is problem of bishul akum because they're not eaten raw. And therefore, if they're now cooked, you've done something to change them. But the Elish nabatro, according to the second lashon, then they are mutarim. That's the view of Rashi. We quoted before the Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel, the girsa or the lashon in the Rabbeinu Chananel is very difficult for the first two, for the dagim ktanim and for the arde. But it's clear by the daisa that he says that it is nechelet b'chai, can be eaten raw. Because sometimes the wheat kernels or the pounded wheat can be eaten raw. Here we see from the Rabbeinu Chananel, that's even ha'idei ha'tachak. That's not the normal way that you would eat it. Despite that fact, he considers it to be nechel chai. But he says the problem is it's in a nechelet b'chai. These aren't items that are eaten together with bread, and therefore, they're not considered as oleh al shulchan melachim. So they gives a different reason over there by the daisa versus Rashi, who says it's just not in oleh al shulchan melachim. He says it's in an echelet imapat. It might be oleh al shulchan melachim, but it's not eaten together with the bread. And then he gives actually a different reason, which is not understandable for the other two, based on what we see in the Gemara. So here you have a question of the Gemara as to my nafkamina. What's the difference between these two items? What you notice over here is that the Gemara only brings nafkamina in a single direction. And the Rabbeinu Tam makes a big deal of this. He says the Gemara could have mentioned something like dvash, honey. Honey is something that is oleh al shulchan melachim, and honey is something that is eaten raw. So therefore it would not be bishul akum according to that. And that would have been a nafkamina in the other direction, where the first version of the statement of Rav would have said it's not bishul akum. And the second statement of Rav would have said that it is bishul akum. How come the Gemara only brought nafkaminot in one direction? Based on this, the Rabbeinu Tam comes to a big chiddush, which is accepted the halacha, and actually is a huge kula in bishul akum. And that is that the Rabbeinu Tam says, you see from here the fact that it didn't mention honey or cheeses, which are ole al shulchan melachim, that are put on the king's table, which means that they would be bishul akum according to that version of Rav. But they are nechalim chai, they are eaten raw, and if that's the case, then they would not be bishul akum according to the first version of Rav. Shma mina, he says from this, the bay the mintkat varim shenasibim lashon acharon mosef al rishon. What it shows you is that the second lashon is not coming to undermine the first lashon, but rather to add on top of it. He's adding an additional qualifier, because otherwise the Gemara should have given nafkaminot in both directions. The fact that the Gemara only searched for nafkaminot in the direction of the second Lashon shows you that the second Lashon also believes that the first Lashon is correct. And he's just building on top of that. And that means, according to the second Lashon, you need both things to be true in order for it to be bishlakum. That means that it has to be not echal chai, it has to be not eaten raw, and it has to be oleh shulchan melachim, it doesn't go onto the table of the king. Both of those together will make a bishlakum according to the second lashon. And that is the way that the Rabbeinu Tam paskins. And he says, whenever we have a machloket like this in two lishonot, we actually went over this before, that there is a machloket vishonim as to how to deal with ikad amres or lishna achrina. This is Rabbeinu Tam l'shitato, that whenever you have a stira between the two lishonot, then here where it's a din derabonon, hochin lahakel, you go to the side kula. If the first lashon believes solely the test is whether it's eden chai or not chai, and then the second lashon believes that you need both tests, that's whether it's echal chai and ole al shulchan melachim, we're going to pass because this is a din derabonon lekula, and therefore say that you need both qualifications in order for it to be bishul akum. And that is a big, big kula that the Rabbeinu Tam suggests over here, and that is accepted the halacha, which is in order for something to be bishul akum, it has to be something that is not ne'echal chai, and also ole al shulchan melachim, which helps to eliminate a large number of items from the problem of bishul akum. Right now the Gemara continues and says, Amravasi Amarav, Dagim Ktanim Miluchim, Ein Bahem Mishum Bishulei Obdei Kochavim. These small salted fish don't have a problem of Bishul Akum. Seemingly the reason is because since they are salted fish, they are now edible in their raw state. And that means that if a goy comes now and cooks the fish afterwards, he's not doing anything that he couldn't have done before, which is he could have eaten it before in its salted state, and therefore cooking of the fish is not necessary in order to make it edible. And that means that it was nechal kashuhu chai. Now the assumption here is that a Jew salted the fish, and the Jew salting the fish already brought it to the state where it's edible, and then when the goy cooks it after that point in time, that has no impact on the fish because it was already nechal chai and there's no bishul akum over here. That's the view of the Balei HaTosafot. Then there are those that suggest that even if the goy himself salted it, and we'll get to that later on in the Gemara, that it might turn out that you can eliminate bishul akum here completely. But that means things like herring, where the fish is salted and it's made edible through the salting or the pickling of the fish, that in of itself makes it that if afterwards it was cooked for whatever reason, that there is no bishul akum over here. The other question the Balei HaTosafot raised over here is, didn't we just say in the Gemara that there are dagim ktanim she'enim oleh shulchan melachim? That was one of the three items, that there was a nafkamina between the two lishonot, and one of them was these small fish that are not ole al shulchan melachim. So why is the Gemara here speaking about the fact that it's salted that excludes it from this din of bishul akum? It should be excluded because it's not ole al shulchan melachim. So the way that the Balei HaTosafot deal with that is to say that these are not small fish, these are medium fish. They are small fish relative to big fish, but they're not small fish relative to small fish. And so they're a little bigger than the fish that we spoke about before. And that's the way that the Balei HaTosafot deal with it. On the other hand, brought down in the Torah, the Beit Yosef suggests over here, it's true that small fish aren't put on the tables of the kings, but after they're salted, they are put on the tables of the kings. And so that's what changes the dynamic. And the Bach makes a simple distinction over there, which is the difference between fish that are at their full growth when they are ktanim, versus fish that are small because they have yet to mature. So if it's a species of fish that grows bigger and you just took it out when it's small, that's ein oleh al shulchan melachim. On the other hand, they're fish that are naturally, that's their full size, which is they're small, like sardines, then that would be something that would be oleh al shulchan melachim. And that's the distinction he makes between the previous Gemara and the statement that we're making over here. Then Amar Rav Yosef, im tzalan obdei kuchavim, Sumech Yisrael alehem mishum eruvei tabshilin. That if an ovei kochavim then roasts the fish after it's been salted, then a Jew can use it for eruvei tabshilin. So we discussed yesterday again the issue of eruv tabshilin. This year it's actually very relevant. By Pesach we're going to have an eruv tabshilin. One of the requirements of an eruv tabshilin is that you have something that is cooked. So you actually have here an interesting predicament. On the one hand, you need a cooked item in order for it to be an eruv tabshilin. So now you're going to say, Rav Yosef says, if the goy roasts it, then it's considered to be cooked for Eruv Tavshilin. On the other hand, if the goy cooks it, it's considered to be cooked for Eruv Tavshilin, then it should also be a problem, Bishulei Obdei Kochavim. So that Rav Yosef is pointing out, despite the fact that it's not Bishul Akum, because it's Nechal Chai, nevertheless, if you do cook it, then it's qualified to be an Erev Tavshilin. So for Erev Tavshilin, it would be considered Bishul. For the din of Bishul Akum, it would not be considered Mevushal. That's the view of the majority of Rishonim, is how to read this Gemara, and they have in here the Girsa of Ovei Kochavim. But if you look in the Balei Tosafot, they say that the Ovei Kochavim only shows up in the next statement of the Gemara, and that is that Rav Yossi says, Im Tzala'an doesn't mean an Ovei Kochavim, it means a Jew. A Jew that cooks them or roasts them at that point, that will be good enough for an Erev Tavshilin, even though they are already qualified and would not be classified as Bishul under Bishul Akum. Nevertheless, if a Jew does cook them or roast them at that point, it will be good for Erev Tavshilin. The Tosafot are doing this because of a sugya that's going to come up in the second half of today's daf, which we'll have to reconcile between this version of the Gemara and that which is said later on in the Gemara. In order to do that, they're making it that there is no Ovei Kochavim involved yet. Then the next case is, Ve'im Avdinu Ovei Kochavim Kasa Daharsana. When Ovei Kochavim takes the salted fish and makes them into fish hash, Asur, that's a problem of Bishul Akum. So here you have a salted fish, which is Nechal Chai, and yet we're still saying there's a problem of Bishul Akum. Gemara says, Pshita, of course there's Bishul Akum there when you make fish hash. Mauditema, what I would have thought is, Harsana Ikar, the fish hash is the Ikar, or is the primary ingredient over here. Kamash Malon, what it shows you is, Kimcha Ikar, it's really the flour that is the primary ingredient. And by the flour, there is a din of Bishul Akum, because the flour cannot be eaten in its raw state. And therefore, when you cook the flour, bake the flour in order to put it into the fish hash, and that makes it something that's edible. And given that, the two things. One is Kimcha Ikar. The Kimcha is the Ikar, which means the bracha here is going to be Borei Minei Mizonot. And number two is that Kimcha Ikar makes that there is Bishul Akum. Had it been for the fish alone, there'd be no problem of Bishul Akum. And that's what we said before. Even if you're tzoleya, the fish, after it's salted, there's no Bishul Akum. So to over here, by the fish hash, that wouldn't have been a problem. It's the kemach, it is the flour that causes the problem in this instance, and therefore there is a problem of Bishul Akum. So this actually has major nafkuminot la'alocha, the fact that the Gemara says over here that kimcha ikar, and you can see this in the Rabbeinu Tam, in the Tvalet Tosfot says, Mikan haya Rabbeinu Tam matir knoish v'oblish shel ovdei kochavim. And from this, the Rabbeinu Tam was matir these types of dishes, otam sheinu nizharim bipachol de kochavim. And for those that don't worry about pat Yisrael and they do eat pat akum, he would say that it's fine. L'may nechush, what do we have to worry about here? Imishum dam beitzim, if you're going to worry about the eggs that are mixed in with this, rov beitzim shalanu ebam dam. The rov of beitzim do not have blood spots in them. So even though we check, because it's something you can check, if after the fact you didn't check, then the assumption is that the robe of beitzim don't have blood spots in them, and therefore they're not problematic. V'im bishum beitzei of tamei, you're worried about the fact that they're mixing in non-kosher eggs instead of kosher eggs in there. Harayena mitzvim beinenu. All the eggs that are found by us are chicken eggs, are kosher eggs. Nobody's bringing in ostrich eggs or any other type of egg in order to make their dishes. V'im bishum bishulei ovdei kochavim. If it's a problem of bishul akum, kim chayikar. Major ingredient here is kemach. Bavikamo pat, and it is like pat, and this is based on Rabbeinu Tam l'shitato that we saw yesterday, that there is the distinction between pat akum and bishul akum, that pat akum was a much later institution than bishul akum, and then the Balei Tosafot believed that pat akum was undermined completely. It was rescinded and repealed by a Beit Din. So now, if you say that the kemach is ikar, and that's by the fact that you make Borei Minei Mizonot on it, that shows that the problem here is pat akum and not bishul akum. And if the problem is pat akum is no longer relevant to us. And that's what the Balei Tosafot note here in the Rabbeinu Tam. For those that eat pat akum, they're not makbid on pat Yisrael, it's pretty clear here that this should be fine. A very interesting Balei Tosafot, it gives you insight into their lives as well as into their view of the halacha of bishul akum and pat akum. Gemara in Chulinim, daf samech dalet amid aleph, says in the Balei Tosafot, Uma she'anu luchim in ovdei kochavim beitzim, the fact that we buy eggs from the non-Jews, afalpi she'enam omrim shel ov ploni, betorim heim, they never tell us that they're coming from kosher birds, and that they are torim, anu subchim arov beitzim shemitzuyim b'neinu, shel ov torim heim. We're lying on this idea that the majority of eggs that are found amongst us and the eggs that are being used by everybody around us are eggs from kosher birds. Uma she'anu luchim in ovdei kochavim oivlish, the kantish. So that's similar to the things that were mentioned here in the Balei Tosafot. So here he gives you a little more indication or understanding what's going on here. that they're kneaded with eggs. Even though you're not allowed to buy scrambled eggs from them if they're mixed up, lo damia. That's not the case. The hacha ikari uta. Because over here there's a bigger problem that they're mixing them up in the kara. So there we're going to be suspect that a Jew sold those eggs to the non-Jew. Because those were eggs from a trefa, and that's why he sold them to them in a scrambled manner so people wouldn't buy them. If you have a dough that is cooked along with the egg, lo chashinan, we don't worry about it. Vazlinan batar rov beitzim she'enam shel trefot. And we follow the rule that the majority of eggs don't come from animals that are trefot. Below chashinan shemaya behem dam, we don't worry about the blood spots. The rov beitzim ein behem dam. Majority of eggs don't have blood spots in them. Masim b'chol yom she'anu ochlim beitzim milgul galot. That we eat these scrambled eggs or hard-boiled eggs. Afu pi she'enan yocholot livadek. Even though you can't check them. Miu, Rabbeinu Tamayo Oser, the Kachman Ode Kochvim, Ublish, Vekaintush. That's the exact opposite of what we have in our Gemara over here. Rabbeinu Tam says you cannot buy them. Mishum Bishule Ode Kochvim, because it's Bishlakum. You can see here in the notes on the side that they mention that fact, and that they say that you have to say one of them is not the Rabbeinu Tam, but one of them is rather the Rabbeinu Chananel, because otherwise it's very hard to reconcile between the two Balei Tosafot. Afagav Damar Rabbi Yishalmi Pat Nimnu Alavi Tiru. Even though Pat Akum based on the Yerushalmi doesn't exist anymore, Shani Hocha, Shini Loshu Bebeitzim. Here they are cooked along with the eggs. Benesru Mitam Shlakot. And they're also because of Bishl Akum of Shlakot, Shloaya Bichlala Heter, which wasn't part of that dispensation. So the Baal Tosafot and Chulin bring for the Rabbeinu Tam the exact opposite conclusion, that over here, the problem isn't Pat Akum, the problem is Bishl Akum, and Bishl Akum was never released, because they are Shtei Gezerot Ayu, and then there are two different gzeirot, and he goes on to explain, like the Rabbeinu Tam, that Pat Akum was a later gzeirah that was undermined, but Bishl Akum was a much earlier gzeirah that was not undermined. And then he goes on, Umi Anira. So then the Tosafot disagrees with that position of the Rabbeinu Tam and says, Vavgav Dermin Alocha Kemanda Asar Beitzim Mishum Bishulei Ovdei Kochavim. Even though the Alocha is like the one who says that Beitzim are problematic for Bishl Akum, Yikom Akum, Isashi Lusha Beitzim. Dough that is kneaded with eggs, ein le'asor mishom de kimcha ikar, like the Tosafot over here, because the flour is primary ingredient. Even the merachim aleha motzi lechem in haaretz. Over here, we're going to make a bracha of a motzi. In our Gemara, it's going to make mizonot, because it's a kasa de harsana. Over there, they're talking about breads. They're going to make a bracha of a motzi lechem in haaretz. Vanu sumchim ala heter di yushami apat. The Baal Tosafot are saying that that's what they relied on. They were buying breads from the non-Jews, and not only were they buying breads, they were buying breads that were mixed with eggs, and they were not worrying about Bishl Akum. It was only a problem of Pat Akum, and Pat Akum is not a problem at all. And there, based on that, he wants to say that you can buy these items, like he says in the Baal Tosafot over here. And then in the end, he concludes, Umitam zeh, en lahatir isasho pashtida. Even though we're matir, the types of items that we mentioned before, which are the oiblish and the kantiush, nevertheless, the pashtida, Shafui ove kuchavim, shasham nunit hu be'en. Because over there, the oil or the fats are still extant al isa, sitting on top of the bread. V'gam etchilato hu ne'asar mishum b'shulei ovdei kuchavim. And from this outset, it's a problem of Bishl Akum. Lo dami le'isa shenilusha be'beitzim. It's not similar to dough that is mixed with eggs. Shabeitza nitbatla mitchila. It's already mixed into the dough from the outset. Lo ne'asar me'olam, and therefore was never subject to Bishl Akum. So that's an important distinction the Baal Tosafot make over there. First of all, the primary ingredient is very important, and you have to look at the primary ingredient in order to understand what the item is, whether it's subject to Pat Akum or Bishl Akum. The second thing is, if you're going to make that distinction, you have to look at how the Bishl Akum comes about. The Bishl Akum comes about separately from the Pat Akum. Then the Bishl Akum, even afterwards, when it's mixed together with the Pat Akum, and the Pat is the Ikar, like the Pashtida, still won't help you because there's already a problem with Bishl Akum. On the other hand, if the eggs, which are already mixed into the dough prior to the time that it's baked, then the primary ingredient takes over and becomes Pat Akum and not Bishl Akum. But you see here that the Baal Tosafot, the Shita Tam, believed that Pat Akum was rescinded or repealed, based on Yerushalmi and based on the statements that we had in yesterday's Gemara from Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, and therefore they were made killed by Pat Akum. And see here that they even make you to buy things that included eggs mixed up in them and even other types of breads that seemingly could have been problematic because of Bishl Akum. Nevertheless, since the pot is the ikar, they said it's Pat Akum and it's not problematic. That is a big dispensation that comes out of this Gemara over here with regards to Kasa de Harsana, that whatever is considered to be the ikar dictates what the nature of this item is. All right, so now the Gemara continues with an interesting story. Amar Rav Bruna, Amar Rav, Ovei Kochavim, Shitzita Teor Ba'agam. He lit a fire in the marsh in this area that he wanted to clear. Kolach HaGavim Sheba'agam Asurim. All the locust grasshoppers in that area are Asurim. Hey Chidami, what exactly happened over here? Ilema Delo Yada Heitahor Veheitamei. If it's because he can't identify the locust anymore because of the fire, so now he doesn't know which ones are kasher and which ones are not kasher. Ma'iria Ovei Kochavim. Why does it matter that a non-Jew set the fire? I feel Israel Nami. If a Jew set the fire, you would have the same problem. From here, the Balei Tosafot back up their position that Mikan Raya Latir Chagavim Velo Shechita. That Chagavim, or eating locusts, do not require Shechita at all. Because you see here from the Gemara, had you been able to identify which ones were kasher and which ones were not kasher, even though they were killed because of the smoke inhalation or because of the fire, they would be perfectly fine to eat. And you see from that that there's no requirement of Shechita by Chagavim. They can be eaten just as dead animals. Then the Balei Tosafot go on to bring it to Sefta that says that you can eat the Chagavim alive and dead. Not only can they be dead, even if they're alive, you can eat. But that Balei Tosafot are perplexed by because the Gemara in other places says it's a problem of Baal Teshachsu to eat Chagavim that are still alive. Therefore, the Balei Tosafot comes up with a compromise, which is that you're not allowed to eat the Chagavim while they're still alive. But if you pull off limbs from a chagav while it's still alive, and then you wash those limbs, you could eat them even though the animal is still alive, even though the chagav is still alive. That is a nafkamina that comes out of this piece of the Gemara. And then the Gemara says, Ela mishum bishulei ovdei kochavim. The problem is bishulakum. He lit the fire and now he cooked all the locusts that were there. The Gemara says, Ki agavna miyosir. That type of bishulakum, is that really asur? V'am Rav Chanan Barami, am Rabbi Ptat, am Rabbi Yochanan, hai ovdei kochavim decharech reisha. This Ovei Kochavim that singed the head of an animal, you're allowed to eat from that animal's head. Afilu miresh onei, even from the edge of the ear. Alma, now what you see from this is that Bure Seyar Kamikave, that the intent of the goy here, what the goy is trying to accomplish here is to remove the hair from the head. He's singeing it over the fire in order to clear all the hair off the head so that he can work with that head now. What ends up happening when he singes the hair off the head is that some of the lighter parts of the head, like the ear, which is just thin cartilage, ends up getting cooked in that process. Despite that fact, you're allowed to eat from the edge of the ear, which got cooked in this singeing process, because the primary purpose of him firing up the animal's head over here is to remove the hair and not to cook it. And since his intent is not to cook, there is no bishul akum when it's a unintended consequence of what he's doing, or in a case where it's just a derivative effect of what he's engaged in. Hachanami, so too in our case, legluya gay agma kamikabe. The reason he's burning down the marsh is to clear the area. He doesn't care about the chagavim. He's not trying to cook the chagavim. That's just a derivative effect of what he's doing. He's trying to clear the marsh area, so he burnt it down to clear the area. So if his intent's not to cook it, then there can't be a problem of bishulakum over here. It says, olam d'lo yada heitahor veheitamei. So the problem here is that he can't identify which of them is kasher and which of them is tamei. Maisa shahaya b'ovei kochavim haya. It just happens to be the incident was an incident with a goy. It's not coming to teach you a lesson that only if a goy did it, if Israel did it, you have the same problem. But here it happened to be a goy. And the problem or the reason you can't eat over here from the chagavim that were cooked is because you can't identify whether they are kasher or not. Gufa. So amar. Now, the Gemara here has a different girsa than the way we quoted it before. And so, therefore, the girsa that we quoted before was, Amar Rav Chanan bar Ami, Amar Rabbi Pedat, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Hai, Ovei Kochavim, Decharech Reisha, Sharech Mecha Minei, Afilum Reish Unei. That's what we said before, that if he's singeing the head of the animal in order to clear off the hair, that if it happens to cook the parts of that animal there, you can eat from them. That's not called Bishlakom. Amar Avina, Hilkach, Hai Ovei Kochavim, Deshoda Sichta Latuna. He throws a coulter into the oven, Vikavar Ba'Yisrael Kra, and a Jew buries a gourd in there, Mi'ikara, from the outset, Shapir Dami. That is just fine. So now here is an interesting situation. The goy is lighting a fire or cooking in the fire in order to work on the coulter. The coulter is a piece of the plowshare that is the blade that goes and digs the furrows in the field. So here he wants to heat it up because he's trying to fix the kli or heat up the kli. So now the Jew goes and buries a gourd in the coals. And that was a way to soften and sweeten up the hard gourds. The same way that people today throw potatoes wrapped up in tinfoil into a fire in order to have them cook inside of the fire. They used to do the same thing. They used to bury the gourds inside the coals. So what this Jew did is before the goy lit the fire or heated it up, he buried a gourd inside of the fire. Now, had it been that the fire was already going and then the Jew put it in, there wouldn't be a problem with Bishul Akum anymore because the Jew himself put it in while the fire was already cooking, and then it'd be Bishul Yisrael, not Bishul Akum. So here's a story where he put it in prior to the oven being heated up, and then the goy heats it up not to cook food, but rather to cook, quote-unquote, a kli. And in cooking the kli, he's not intending to cook any items. Turns out that as a byproduct or derivative of that, he ends up cooking the gourd. That's not considered to be Bishul Akum. That'd be a extrapolation from what we have been saying until now based on Rabbi Yochanan and the singeing of the hair of the animal's head. So where it says pshita, that seems to be a straightforward extrapolation. No, when he's cooking over here, he is quote-unquote cooking the kli, and that's his intention. So even though he may not be cooking in the sense of food, he's still cooking in the sense of putting the kli in the fire to cook the kli, and in cooking the kli, he's still cooking. And cooking is cooking, and therefore it'd be a problem. Kamash Malan, Lishrure Mono Kamikavin. He's not trying to cook the utensil, but he's rather trying to harden the utensil. The Gemara in Shabbat, it's also Gemara in Yoma as well, speaks about the fact that when you heat up metal, at first it softens, and then it hardens afterwards. It becomes stronger afterwards, because then the impurities are burnt off, and then it becomes a stronger metal and actually hardens better after you fired it up. So the firing in the initial stages causes a cooking, quote-unquote, a softening of the metal, but then in the latter stages actually strengthens the metal. The word shrure, the modern word in Hebrew, shririm, is for muscles, but it means that it's hardened now, and therefore the intent of the individual here is not to cook the kli, but rather to harden the kli, and that's why he's putting it into the fire, and that's why it's not a problem of bishul akum, even though, as the Balei Tosafot point out, the Gemara in Shabbat seems to come to the opposite conclusion. Gemara in Shabbat says if you fire up a metal object in the fire on Shabbat, you're chayav mishum bishul, because the initial stages involve bishul, and only in the latter stages does it become hardened. And therefore, for Shabbat, you're chayav for bishul. So what you see here is that there are different standards by Shabbat than there are by bishul akum. By Shabbat, it says that the requirement is melachat machshevet, that you have to accomplish a full melacha, and that has to be your intent. Over here, your intent is to cook the metal. Even though the end game of the metal will be hardened, in the initial stages will be softened, and in that stage you have completed the whole melacha bishul, and you're going to be chayav, even though there's still a further part of the process to be done. On the other hand, by bishul akum, it all has to do with the final outcome that you're looking at. Based on that final outcome, it will deem it not bishul akum, because you're not intending to be mevashel the metal, you're intending to harden the metal, that is your final intent, and that will dictate with regards to bishul akum. So that's the way that the Balei Tosafot note that there are different standards for Bishul B'Shabbat and for Bishul Akum. Whereas Rashi over here says something that's interesting. He says that Ein Bishul B'Kelim, that there is no such thing as Bishul by Kelim. That's the Kamash Malan of the Gemara. Now, if you do say that, like Rashi says over here, that makes the Gemara in Shabbat very difficult. Because then the Gemara in Shabbat, how can you be Chayav for Bishul if, according to Rashi, Ein Bishul B'Kelim? There's no such concept. There's no such idea as Bishul B'Kelim. And that's how what he thinks the Kamash Malan is. Kamash Malan is telling you that this is not called Bishul, this is called Shrure, not that there are actually two stages in the process like the Balei Tosafot say. And that's a difficulty with Rashi that leads the Balei Tosafot to give this alternative answer. And therefore, by Bishul Akum, we're going to be Mekil, because by Bishul Akum, we look more holistically at the whole situation, and we do not look at each individual part or stage in the cooking process. Now, what's also interesting over here is that the Rif clearly had a different girsa in the Gemara over here. If you actually look in the Rosh, Rosh actually quotes that girsa of the Rif and explains it in the following manner. V'hilchot Rav Alfis Katav, Kavar Be Yisrael Kra, Mi'ikara Shaper Dami, Libasof Asur. He puts in the gourd up front. Originally, that's not a problem. But if he puts it in the end, then it is a problem, which is the opposite of what we said. We said the whole problem here is that he's putting it in from the outset before the oven was heated up. If the oven was heated up, it would certainly not be a problem, because then it would be Bishul Yisrael, not Bishul Akum. Here the Rosh explains that girsa of the Rif in the following manner. Came into cover by Yisrael, le'ein oved kochavim. What does it mean, basof? If he buries the gourd there, with the oved kochavim being aware of that, then afagav de lo kivin de basof, de vashel asichta, chayshinan shema kivin de vashel hakra. came into the diaba. Even though his intent when he's firing up the oven is to cook the kli, nevertheless, because he's aware of the fact that you put a gourd in there, maybe he also has intent to cook the gourd, not just to heat up the kli. V'lo sharinan elahecha de kavar ba yisro mikara, v'lo yoda ba ovi kochavim. The only time we're matir it is when the Jew buries the gourd in the coals without the knowledge of the Obed Kochavim. So the Rif's Girsa and the Rosh explanation of that significantly narrows the scope of this heter, which is that if the Goy is aware of the fact that you put the item in there, then there might be a problem with Bishul Akum, because yes, what he's doing for the Kli is not called Bishul, but his knowledge or his knowing that you put in the item there might mean that he's heating the fire, knowing that he's both cooking his Kli and also cooking your gourd. And that would be problematic. Whereas if the Yisrael puts it in there unbeknownst to the Goy, then there won't be a Bishul Akum problem, because that's just a derivative effect of his cooking the item. So that is an addition of the Rif and the Rosh's explanation of the Rif that does narrow this significantly. Right now, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Heniach Yisrael Basara Gabe Gechalim. A Jew leaves meat on the coals, Vaalvei Kochavim Vafachbo, and then an Akum comes along and starts flipping the burgers on the grill, Mutar. That's not a problem of Bishul Akum. Hey Chidami, what exactly is the situation? Ilema Dilo Vafachbe have a Boshil. If it was the fact that the meat would have cooked, even if he didn't flip it, pshita, then of course there's no bishul akum here because he didn't do anything significant in the cooking process. Elav di lo afach lo avibashil. So it sounds like that the meat would not have cooked had he not flipped it over. Amai mutar. Why is that considered to be okay? Bishulei obdei kuchavim ninu. That's classic bishul akum. The item would have cooked without the guy. It's raw meat. And now he's flipping the burgers and making that they cook. So lo, tzricha, this is the case. Di lo hafach hava bushel betarte shoy. Had you just left it on the grill, it would have taken 2 hours for it to cook, because it's cooking slowly and you're not flipping it over. Vahashto, now that he's flipping over the meat on the grill, kabushel bechadashato. It only takes an hour instead of 2 hours. So he's accelerating the bishul process. Mao de tema kruve bishula miltohi. I would have thought that accelerating the cooking process is considered to be significant, and therefore be a problem with Bishul Akum, Kamash Malan, that is not considered to be Bishul Akum. So the principle that's being established here, which is important in Bishul Akum, is that as long as the Jew puts the item in a position where it could have cooked, then if the Goy then intervenes and does things to accelerate the cooking or to make the cooking better, that does not change it into Bishul Akum, because it would have cooked based on the action of the Jew already. V'amar Rav Asiyam Rav Yochanan, Koshum k'machal ben Jusai, ein bo mishum mishulei obdei kochavim. Didn't Rav Asiyam Rav Yochanan say that once you reach the threshold of machal ben Jusai, that no longer has a din of Bishul Akum? Machal ben Jusai comes up in the Gemara in Shabbat with regards to the minimum threshold for cooking. It's an important halacha in Shabbat that once an item passes that point, it's already considered to be mivushal, and therefore there are a lot of kulot that exist once you pass the point of machal ben drusai. What machal ben drusai is machloket Rashi and the Rambam as to whether it is one-third cooked or one-half cooked. Rashi says it's a third, and the Rambam says it's a half, in order for it to be a machal ben drusai. What Rabbi Yochanan is saying over here by Bishul Akum is, if you already crossed that threshold, then it's not considered to be Bishul Akum. So if you cross that threshold and then the goy gets involved and starts to work on the cooking, that's not a problem, because it's already reached the threshold of what's otherwise deemed bishul for halachic terms. And Machal ben Jusai is based on the fact that Machal ben Jusai was a famous mafioso in the time of the Gemara, and since he was always trying to run away and escape from the authorities, he never had enough time to cook his meat fully. And so he was always eating his meat partially cooked, and that was his type of meat or type of cooking that was well known to people around. He must have been a figure that was not off in the distance or imaginary, but someone that people met, and they knew that he ate meat in that manner. But the Gemara says, based on that, ha ein kamachom dusai, yeshbo mishum leobdei kochavim. That means if the Jew doesn't get it past that threshold of machal ben dusai, then if the goy interferes at that point, there will be a problem of bishul akum. So in our case, why isn't there a problem of bishul akum when he interferes? It says, hotam kagon the otve besilta. But there is a case where, according to Rashi, put it into a basket, vishakle uve kochavim otve betanura. And then the goy took it from the basket and placed it into the stove or into the oven. The original process was started by the Jew in a basket where it really wouldn't have cooked over there. It wouldn't have been able to reach the point of bishul. And since it would never reach the point of Bishul, or never cross the threshold of Machal ben Drusai, then when the Goy moves it into the oven at that point in time, he's doing something significant. He's actually creating the Bishul at that point,
And therefore, it's considered to be a problem of Bishul Agum. Others say that Silta means a log of wood that is in the fire, where one end of the log is in the fire, the other end of the log is not in the fire. The Jew put it on the end that wasn't in the fire, and therefore it would never have cooked. And the Goy moves it over to the side that's in the fire, moves it into the oven. That's again considered Bishul Agum because he changed the standing of the item. The item would not have cooked in its current state. And now his changing of that makes it that it will cook. And therefore he becomes the primary agent for the Bishul over here. And that's why it's a problem of Bishul Akum. And so basically the concept was that it wouldn't have cooked to Machal Ben Dushai with the Jew's action. And the Goy now moved it so that it will cook past that threshold and will cook completely. And that's why there's a problem with Bishul Akum over here. Although the Ravid suggests over here that even if the meat could have reached Machal Ben Dushai on its own, since the Goy made such a significant change in the way that it's being cooked, that is a problem of Bishul Akum. That's a big chumrah that the Ravid introduces over here, which is that even if the Jew put it into a position where it could cook, but it would cook in a way that was either subpar or would not cook in a manner that was even remotely considered to be cooking, nevertheless, it would have made it to that threshold. That's not enough. Because here the Goy who changes it to the other venue is making such a significant change that actually makes it into Bishul Akum when he makes that change. That is a chumrah that the Ravid notes over here, though the majority of the Rishonim will explain like Rashi, or the other Rishonim, it would never have reached Machal Ben Dushai. And that's why when the Goy moves it into a position where it does cook and will cross over the threshold of Machal Ben Dushai, it's considered to be Bishul Akum over here. But that means that if the Goy is simply accelerating the cooking process, like we said before, that would not be a problem of Bishul Akum. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports that. Meniach Israel Basar Al Gabe Gechalim. The Jew can put meat on coals. Uvaove Kuchavim Umhapech Bo. Then the Goy can come and flip the burgers and flip over the meat. Achivo Yisrael mi Beit Knesset mi Beit Midrash. Till the Jew returns from Shul, or the Jew returns from the Beit Midrash. Ve'eno Choshesh. And he doesn't have to worry about it. Now, obviously there is two problems over here. There's one problem, which is the problem of Bishul Akum. That's the statement that we said before, that there's no Bishul Akum when he accelerates the cooking. So over here, that won't be a problem of Bishul Akum. There's a secondary problem of Bishul Akum, which is what Rashi spoke about at the top of the Amud here, and the Baal Tosafot rejected that. Rabbi Eli Tosafot said it's all a problem Mishum Chatnut. Rashi said there's also a problem if Klufe, that he's going to swap it out with non-kosher meat. And so over here, that would be a secondary problem. Why aren't we worried about the fact that the meat's going to be swapped out for non-kosher meat? So here, the Rabbeinu Chananel says that the last line of Rabbeinu Chananel says, V'hani mile deleka chashash dilma cholifle. This has to be a situation in which there's no chashash that he can change out the meat. Either there's another Yisrael watching him, or for whatever reason he's mirtad, he has a fear to switch it out or swap it out because of problems that would be caused by that. There has to be some mitigating factor that doesn't allow him to switch the meat. But if that is true, then we don't have a problem with Bishul Akum, because all he's doing is accelerating the cooking over here. Now the Braita continues, and the Braita has what seemingly is a very avant-garde statement over here, which makes people wonder about the girsa of the Braita, which is, Shofeta Dishak Tera Gabi Kira, a woman can place a cauldron or a cooking pot on the stove, Uvat Ovedet Kochavim, and then a non-Jewish woman can come, Megisa, and she can mix it, Asha Tovo, until the woman returns, Mi Beit HaMerchatz, from the bathhouse, or Mi Beit HaKnesset, or from Shul. Whoa, that means that in the time of the Tanaim here, we're talking about a Tosefta, the women were in shul. And speaking about here, that the woman went to the Beit HaMerchatz, okay, she went to the bathhouse, but also saying here that she went to Beit Knesset. By the man, it said Beit Knesset and Beit Midrash. By the woman, it says Beit Knesset and Beit Merchatz. Okay, she didn't go to the Beit Midrash. That's understandable. That makes sense. The fact that she was in the Beit Knesset shows that women were attending shul at the time of the Tanaim. So there are two ways to deal with that. One is to say that Beit Knesset in the Tanaim does not always mean a shul. Beit Knesset means a meeting place or a gathering place, and maybe that's what the reference is. Or you look in the Rabbeinu Chananel, on the top line of the Rabbeinu Chananel on the Amud, it says, "Chenisha she'en sham chashisha shema tachlif." Again, here it's a case where there's no worry about the woman swapping out the item that is being cooked there. And ad she'teitzei min hamerchatz, so the woman returns from the bathhouse. Oh, min hashuk, or she returns from the marketplace. The girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananel was not Beit Knesset, but rather shuk. That would be much more plausible in a girsa of a Tanaic work, that the woman was returning from the Beit HaMerchatz and the Shulk, and not returning from the Beit HaKnesset. Nevertheless, the girsa that we have is Beit HaKnesset, and that's a very interesting sociological insight into whether women attended Shul at that point in time. So that proves what we said before,
that if a goy is involved in the process of cooking, that doesn't change the fact that there is no bishul akum over here. So now the Gemara says, Ibalu, heniach oveg kochavim. What happened if it's the other way around? The non-Jew placed it on the fire, v'afach Yisrael, and the Jew is flipping the burgers, and the Jew is the one that's excelling the process. Mahu, what's the din here? Amar Nachum Yitzchak kavachomer. That's a kavachomer. Gamro biyad oveg kochavim. If the completion of the process took place in the hands of the oveg kochavim, Mutar, it's still not considered to be Bishul Akum. I mean, the Jew started it, and the goy is flipping it and finishing it off afterwards. That's not considered Bishul Akum. Gamero b'yad Yisrael. If the Jew finishes the cooking process, Svoko Shekain, certainly it should not be a problem with Bishul Akum. So the underlying assumption here is that the completion of the cooking process is what is the major aspect of cooking. And therefore, if it's a goy who finishes it, it's not considered to be Bishul Akum. Then certainly if a Jew finishes it off, it's not considered to be Bishul Akum. And here, the Ramban adds on an additional nimuk, which is that the problem that we said before is mishum chatnut. It's the problem of intermarriage and socializing. And over here, you see that when the goy finishes it, where you're more likely to have hakarat atov to him, because he did the major aspect of the cooking, and he's bringing you the completed item. And there we say there's no bishul akum. And certainly in the case where the Jew finishes it off, where he's the one who's going to take major credit, then certainly you shouldn't worry about chatnut in that case. And that's why it's a kav chomer, and there's no problem over here. Itmar nami. Another statement by the Amoreim. Amar Rav Barchana, Rav Yochanan. Rami lo Amar Rav Acha Bar Barchana. Amar Rav Yochanan. Ben sheniach oveg kochavim afach Yisrael. Whether it was the oveg kochavim that put it on the fire, and the Jews doing the flipping. Ben sheniach Yisrael. Whether it's the Jew that put it on the fire, afach oveg kochavim, and the non-Jew is doing the flipping, mutar. That's not a problem. Veino asur, achei tchilato. The only problem is if the process of cooking was done from beginning to end by the Oved Kochavim, then it would be problematic in terms of Bishul Akum. But if Israel is involved in any one of those stages, then that would be sufficient. Amar Ravina, Hilchata, the halacha is, Harifto, if you have bread, the Shagar Oved Kochavim, that the non-Jew lit the fire, heated up the oven to bake the bread, Bafa Israel, and the Jew baked the bread in it, inami, or if it's vice versa, shug Israel, the Jew lit the fire, heated up the oven, va'afa oveg kochavim, and then the non-Jew baked the bread, inami, or here's the biggest kula, shugar oveg kochavim, va'afa oveg kochavim, that both the non-Jew lit the oven, stoked the oven, heated up the oven, and he baked the bread, va'ata Israel, and then the Jew comes along, v'chata ba'chituyei, and stokes the coals, stokes the fire, shapir dami, that is good enough to be considered not bishul akum. As long as the Jew does something in the process, that's not considered to be bishul akum. Here we have a major, major machloket amongst the Rishonim, which has major nafkamino to halacha as to what the Jew has to do in order to rid the process of being a process of bishul akum. So from the Gemara over here, it seems like he does not have to have a significant part in the cooking process. He can have even an insignificant part in the cooking process, and that would deem it that it's not bishul akum anymore. The Ramban suggests that he has to be a little more significant, which is kutuye. He has to actually stoke the coals and increase the fire. So he has to do something of some significance where he's actually increasing the fire. It's not enough that he just touches it. He has to do something that actually increases the fire, or makes it that the item is now cooking faster or hotter in the oven, in order for it not to be classified as bishul akum. But there are others that suggest over here that that's not the case. And if you look in the Baal HaTosafot Tosafot, he says, mikulan shmaitin, from everything that we read here, mashma debi'in and sheyisrael mikarev habishul ktzat, that the Jew has to actually accelerate the cooking process in some way. That's the conclusion you would come from the piece of Ravina. That's what the Ramban said, that if you have to be chutuya, you have to increase the heat in the oven in order for it to be classified as you're taking away bishul akum, and that it's now bishul Yisrael. What about the fact that we just throw some splinter or toothpick into the tanur? Some chim. So then how can we rely on that to say that it's now bishul Yisrael? So chim mash yesh bidvarim sheben b'nei bavel the b'nei eretz Yisrael. They're someich on this sefer that brings down the differences between the practices of b'nei bavel and b'nei Yisrael. The kamar, the b'nei bavel mashkachim kisam l'tanur, that the people of bavel would just throw a little splinter into the oven, and that would be considered Bishul Yisrael are no longer Bishul Akum. Ubnei Marav, and those in Eretz Yisrael, Omrim, Kisam, Zeh, Mamalah, Omamurid. This Kisam that you throw into the fire, why does it change anything? You're not doing anything of significance. Banu Nipshachim Achar Bnei Bavel V'Talmudam. Balitos would say, we paskin like Bnei Bavel. And Bnei Bavel said a Kisam is sufficient in this case. So now here you have a major machloket in the Rishonim. The Baal Tosafot are saying that you can even do an insignificant action, and that will be classified as being Bishul Yisrael. Whereas from the Gemara, or the basic reading of the Gemara, it seems to be that in order for it to be Bishul Yisrael, you require that the Jew, in somehow or some way, accelerates the cooking process. Whether that means he's flipping the item, whether it means that he's baking the item, or whether that means that he's stoking the fire to make it hotter, he needs to do something of significance in order for it to be not considered to be Bishul Akum. So now that leads to Machloket in the Rishonim as to what is required in order to make it Bishul Yisrael. Tosfot says anything insignificant does the job based on the quote that they have about what the Bnei Bavel's practice was. Whereas the other Rishonim, and I'm going to read you the Rosh now, the Rosh over here explains what the Tosfot says. Why are people allowed to do this? And he quotes the same sefer that the Baal HaTosafot are quoting. He says, "V'efshar shenagu arishonim b'tchilat hesek koshel tanur." Maybe what they're speaking about here is at the beginning of the cooking process, he would put some of the coals in, v'kisam la'alot shalhevet, and then he put in some kindling to have the fire ignite. So there he's doing something significant in the cooking process. And even though afterwards the Najju comes and then puts in all these logs and does everything in order to heat it up, but fine, he baked it. Since the beginning of the lighting, based on that, then maybe that's considered to be as if the Jew did everything. People saw this as being a dispensation, and then they mistakenly extrapolated to say that if you throw in a splinter at any time, that is sufficient. But that's not true. It was that the Jew started the fire, and that's what made it significant, but that's not something you can extrapolate and say that you can just throw in a kisam. He says, the lishnod gemara lo mashma hochi. Says the gemara does not say that. Better to leave an esel shiv shogegim by two mezi yedim, which means the Rosh thinks this is wrong, that this practice is incorrect. So here you have the Baal Tosafot bringing this practice down. And he also quotes from the Rambam. And the Rambam says something of a similar nature. The Jew joins in anything to do with the baking of the bread. It's fine. Even if he throws like a piece of wood into the tanur, that's because the whole point of the Jew being a part of the process is not because he did something significant in the bishul. It's just to show or demonstrate that bishul akum is asur. So to show or make a heker that there is a problem over here, the Jew has to do something. It could be any minor thing, any insignificant thing, just to show that there's a problem of Bishul Akum, and this is how we're overcoming that problem of Bishul Akum. According to the Rambam, the Baal HaTosafot over here, you don't need to do anything significant, even anything insignificant would suffice to make it Bishul Yisrael. The other Rishonim, as you can see, the Rosh, the Ramban, all disagree with this and say you have to do something significant in the cooking process, somehow accelerate the cooking process in order for it to be Bishul Yisrael. And one of the things they note over here, and this becomes a major distinction that the Rabbeinu Tam himself makes, but does not abide by over here, is that there's a major difference between pot and bishul. And what many of the Rishonim point out over here is that the het there derived from pot akum and not bishul akum. The whole Gemara that's speaking over here, and all these incidences where they say that the insignificant act is enough are all dealing with pot. And that's because the pot akum is a much more relaxed type of isur. It's a much less significant problem, especially according to Baal HaTosafot, where there's no pot akum at all. That's why they allow this insignificant act over here. On the other hand, if it comes to real bishul akum, over there you don't have that dispensation. And therefore the Rishonim paskin against this view of the Baal HaTosafot, against this view of the Rambam, and say it's uniquely associated with pot, where you can make an insignificant action, but when it comes to real bishul, then you have to do something that accelerates the cooking process, and the halacha that turns out to be a difference between B'nai Sefarad and B'nai Ashkenaz, and that is the Shulchan Aruch quotes the halacha in the following manner, V'afilo zarak al eitz achad atoch atonor, yitil kol hapat shebo, she'ena davar liyot heker, shapat shelehen asura. That's with regards to pot, but
When it comes to Bishul, the Shulchan Aruch says, Kol Shebishlo Yisrael Ma'at Bishulo. As long as the Jew participated in the cooking process, Ben Mitzchila, Ben Basov Mutar, whether it's in the beginning or the end or anywhere along the process, that is fine. So you see here that, according to the Shulchan Aruch, pot, you can take an insignificant act. When it comes to Bishul, then you have to be a part of the Bishul process in order for it not to be classified as Bishul Akum. And he says, Ein Shkirat, meaning that the starting of the fire, or the placing a small item into the tanur, mo'elet ela bapat, that only helps you by bread. Avo b'shar mitbashlin, ein shkirat tanur, b'lo hadlakat eish male morid. Starting the fire, or throwing something into the fire, makes no difference, ela hanacha dafko. Your placing of the item in there to cook is what makes the difference. If you place the item in there to cook, then you're the one who put it in to start cooking. You have to do something significant within the process of the cooking. Otherwise, it's not considered to be Bishul Yisrael. And the Rama over there says, Ve'yesh chokim. There are those that disagree with this. Usvir la dadlakat esh, uchitoi b'kali mahani. If you light the fire, or you stoke the coals, that's enough. Linyan bishul, kamo linyan pat. V'chein noagim. And that is the minog of the Ashkenazim. And he brings that from the Hagod, Sharei Dora, ubli oroch, ube mordechai, v'afilu chitoi b'lo kavana mahani moyo. Even if you just stoke the fire without any intent to cook, that's enough. Even in the case where the Jew doesn't stoke and he doesn't throw anything in there, even if the non-Jew lights a fire from a Jewish fire, he transfers the fire over, shari, that is mutar. And again, he brings Ashkenazi poskim to support that. And that is the way the B'nai Ashkenaz are noheg, that the Jew only has to do something insignificant. For instance, if you have a pilot light based on this, that would be sufficient in order to deem it not Bishul Akum. Because if the Jew lights the pilot light, that means that any time the Goy then is lighting the burners, he's transferring a Eish Yisrael to make the fire. And that is, according to the Rama over here, totally fine. It's not subject to Bishul Akum. As well as the fact is that if the Jew just puts the item in or starts the process any time, if he lit the fire, that would be enough according to the Ashkenazim. And based on that, there is a device that was created by Tzomet today whereby the ovens need to be started by the Jew in order for it not to be Bishul Akum. They created a new system by which the Mashkiach doesn't even have to be there to light the ovens. He can call on his cell phone, and he punches in a code, and it remotely starts the ovens. And therefore, the Jew is the one who's starting the oven, and not the Goy, and they get rid of the problem of Bishul Akum. For the Sfaradim, that would not be sufficient. The Sfaradim have a much higher standard of Bishul Akum, and therefore, especially in Chutz La'aretz for Sfaradim, there is a bigger issue of Bishul Akum, because they require some sort of involvement in the cooking process, and not just the lighting of the fire, the starting the fire of the B'nai Ashkenaz. And that's why, generally in Eretz Yisrael, it's not as big a deal, but in Chutz La'aretz, it's a much bigger deal, where many Sfaradim cannot eat from the Ashkenazi Hashkacha when it comes to restaurants or stores where there are non-Jews cooking, because they're only abiding by the Ramah and the practice of the Ashkenazim, which is not a high enough standard for those that follow the Psak of the Shulchan Aruch, that you need something significant in the cooking process. Now, over here, there's an important Rabbeinu Chananel, which is actually quoted the Halacha. Rabbeinu Chananel over here qualifies all these statements of the cooking or the Jews' involvement in the cooking over here and the non-Jews' involvement in the cooking, where he says, Ubalad shalayte bi'arubi kochavim bishul kamachal ben dusai. It only works for the Jew to make it bishul Yisrael if the item was not cooked k'machal ben drusai by the Goy. That means if the Goy started the cooking process and it reached machal ben drusai, then if the Jew intercedes at that point and it starts to cook it, that will not help. Even though the Gemara over here says if the Jew finishes it off, it's fine. What the Rabbeinu Chananel qualifies and says, that's only if the thing hasn't reached machal ben drusai. If it already reached machal ben drusai, then that's too far along in the cooking process, and it's considered the Bishul Akum even if the Jew intervenes at that point. So that's not found in the Gemara. But the Rabbeinu Chananel twice, both on the previous Amud and here on this Amud, makes that qualification in the Gemara that it has to be below Machal ben Dusai when the Jew intervenes in order for it to be not considered to be Bishul Akum. And that is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch as well. In Bishlo of Dei Kochavim Kamachal ben Dusai Gamaro Yisrael Yesh Le'esor. Then it should be Asor. Whereas the Rama quotes over there, V'yesh Matirim B'chol Inyan. And are those that are Matir in any way? And he quotes here, it's such a long list of poskim, including the Rosh, the Ran, the Rif, Samak, the Smag, that were posek the Heter. And he says that we're not abiding by that. Even if the Jew intervenes at any point in time, even if the goy brings it past the threshold of machal medusai, it's not considered to be bishul akum. Again, here it'll be another case where the svaradim are significantly more machmir than the ashkenazim with regards to bishul akum, and that can cause other problems again with the ashkenazi hashkocha for those that are following the psak of the shulchan aruch. There's also a large range of tshuvot with regards to non-Jewish help in the Jew's home. The Shulchan Aruch says, Yesh mishe matir b'shpachot shelanu. Some people are matir with the women that work in our houses. Yesh mishe oser b'afilu b'diavad. There are people that say it's problematic, even b'diavad. Although the Rama says, b'diavad, yesh l'smocha divrei matirim, that in a case of b'diavad, we would say that we're sumech on the matirim. Rafilu lachatchila noagim lachel, the Rama says, Beit Yisrael sheshvachot v'abadim mevashlim beBeit Yisrael, when the non-Jews are cooking there, ki ei efshar shelo yechateh echad mibnei habayit ma'at. It's impossible that one of the people in the house wouldn't stoke the fire somewhat or do something in that process in order to make it mutar. So obviously it would be a big kula that might actually not be applicable today, because today we don't have that idea of people stoking the fire. As well as the Gra and the Shach point out, that the shvachot that the Shulchan Aruch is speaking about are shvachot that are knuyot, that are bought and owned by the individual. But today, where the help that's in our house is not owned by us, they work for us as schirim, that they would have a much different status. And many of the poskim are very machmir here. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says that even the kelim in the house may have a problem or chashash of tarfut if the non-Jewish help is there, because she has nobody stopping her if she's alone in the house. And she can cook whatever she wants and mix things up without anybody else knowing. And Menashe Klein in the Mishnah Halacha comes out very strongly against it. And he says that people need to be made aware of the fact that non-Jewish help in the house has serious issues with bishul akum. Right now the Gemara continues and says, Dag meliach, salted fish, chizki ashari, Rabbi Yochanan asar. Chizki said it's fine. Rabbi Yochanan says it's problematic. Beitzat sluya, a roasted egg, bar kapara ashari. Bar Kappara said it's no problem. Rabbi Yochanan asar. Kiata Rav Dimi amar. When Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael, he combined both of the deot. Echad dag maliach, echad beitzat sluya. When it comes to a salted fish, and when it comes to a roasted egg, Chizki or Bar Kappara asharu. Chizki and Bar Kappara said it's mutar. Rabbi Yochanan asar. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says it's asur. So Rashi explains, and many Rishonim disagree with Rashi, but Rashi's statement over here has huge nafkaminot, which is, Rashi says that the case here is a case where the non-Jew salted the fish. So the non-Jew who salted the fish, he says, the lav hu bishul. That's not considered to be bishul. So even though the non-Jew now is moving the fish from being inedible to edible, he's doing it through a salting process. And based on that, Chizki and Bar Kappara say it's not subject to bishul akum because he's not doing bishul. He's doing salting. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says that is the equivalent of bishul. And since it's the equivalent of bishul, therefore it's considered to be bishul akum. So obviously the way Rashi is explaining it says major nafkamino as to whether making something edible in a manner that is not bishul, does that make it into a problem of bishul akum? Because over here there's no fire, there's no cooking, it's salting that's doing it. Is that enough to render it to be considered bishul or not considered bishul? And so that would have major nafkamino. And then Rashi says by the egg, the reason that it's not considered to be bishul akum is because the egg is enclosed in its shell. And since it's enclosed in a shell, the goy can never touch the egg. And so therefore there's no problem of bishul akum because the goy can't touch the egg. For whatever reason, Rashi believes that the access to the item is a part of the problem of bishul akum, whether he thinks that's because of a chlufe, because of the fact that you would swap it out, and over here where it's enclosed, you can't swap it out, even though you can swap out the total egg. Nevertheless, he considered it not to be bishul akum for that reason, or it's simply because the takana was only with foods that he could access. That's the way Rashi reads the Gemara. The Rishonim argue on both of those points. Many Rishonim say over here that the issue of the salting over here is not that they salted the fish. That's not the problem. The problem is that they salted the fish, and then they cooked the fish afterwards. So that raises an interesting issue, and this goes back to the gears of the Bali Tosafot in the previous Amud, which is over here. What happened was that the non-Jew salted the fish, and then the non-Jew cooked the fish. As opposed to, on the previous Amud, there was a case where the Jew salted the fish, and then only afterwards, either the Goy cooked it according to the other Rishonim, according to Bali Tosafot, the Jew also cooked it after that. But then, there's no problem with Bishul Akum, because the Jew was the one who moved it from being the inedible state to the edible state. Over here, you have actually a case where the non-Jew moved it from inedible to edible through salt. Then afterwards, he cooked it. So now the question is there bishul akum over here? Because in essence, the Nanjum brought it from a point of being raw all the way to the point of being cooked. But he did it in two stages. He did it one in the salting stage and then one in the cooking stage afterwards. And so the question is his salting of it make it that it is now because it is a big fish as opposed to the smaller fish we spoke about on the previous amud. And therefore, it's only eaten in emergency situation or in certain situations people eat them. It's not the normal way to eat them. And if you say that's not a problem of bishlakum, then he cooks it afterwards. Is that a problem of bishlakum? Even though in the previous amud we said it was no problem, that's because there the Jews salted it. But here where the goy salted it and cooked it, can you say then it's not bishlakum? So basically what you could have is this two-stage process where the goy could remove the problem of bishlakum by himself. Because he salts it first, makes it edible, and then cooks it. So there's no bishlakum because now it's edible. And that's the way that most of the Rishonim read it over here. But that's the question of the Gemara over here as to whether that second cooking process on top of the salting process is that considered to be Bishul Akum? Because in the entirety of the process was now done by the Goy or the Akum, is that a problem of Bishul Akum? And with regards to the egg, dispensation is not because it's covered in a shell, rather because it's Nechala Yedei Dechak, that eggs can be eaten raw in a emergency situation, or in certain situations, people eat eggs that are raw. It's not the normal way to eat them, but Yedei Dechak, you eat them. And that's the Machloket here. Is that enough to consider Nechal Chai when it's done Yedei Dechak? And that goes back to the Machloket Rishonim before, as to what is the definition of Nechal Chai. Here you have something that's Nechal Chai, Yedei Dechak. So here you have a Machloket as to whether that's considered to be a problem of Bishlakum or not Bishlakum. Kiata Rav Dimi Amar Echad Dad Migliach Lechad Bitzat Sluya Chizkia Ubar Kapara Sharu Rav Yochanan Asar. So now we have the same Mesorah brought when Rav Dimi comes from Eretz Yisrael telling us this is the Machloket between them. Rav Chia Parva Ikla Beiresh Galuta Amrolei Beitzat Sluya Mai. What's the story with Beitzat Sluya? Is that considered to be Bishlakum? Amrolei Chizkia Bar Kapara Sharu. He says that Chizkia Bar Kapara were Matir, Rabbi Yochanan Asar, Bein Dvarav Shalachad, B'Makom Shnayim. It's two against one. We pass them like the majority, and therefore it's mutar, there's no problem with Bishlakum. The non-Jews that are working in the house of the Reish Galuta can continue to cook the eggs. Amrolei Rav Zvid. Rav Zvid, who was resident there and was an advisor, or a rabbinic advisor, spoke up and says, Lo tatitule, don't listen to him. Hachi amar Abaye. Hilchata kavati de Rabbi Yochanan. Abaye says, the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan over here, and it's asur. Ashkiyu neguta dechala. And they gave him a cup or a draft of chometz vinegar. Must have been either poisonous vinegar or very strong vinegar. But nach nafshei, and he died from it. They basically knocked off Rav Zvid, because he wanted to be machmir and tell him that there was a problem of bishlakum over here. And they didn't want that to be the case. So they got rid of Rav Zvid. A very extreme case here, or a way to deal with the issue, but they didn't like the psak of that rub, so they got rid of him, because they liked the psak that it was mutar. Alright, Tanu Rabbanan. Hakafrisin, Rashi says over here that these are caper bushes. Hakaflutot, Rashi says are leeks. Vamatalia, Rashi says is liverwort. Vachamin, and hot water. Vaklayot, and roasted items, shalan, mutarim. All of these items are mutar, they don't have a problem with bishlakum. Beitzat skuya asura. A beitza that is roasted is asur. Shemen, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, ubeitino, nimnu ala veitirua. Comes to oil, then there's no problem because they got rid of the problem of shemen akum. So over here you have a list of items, first of all, that are not subject to bishlakum. And similarly, the reason being is that they are nechalim chayin. All these items are eaten in their raw state. That is the capers, the leeks, and the liverwort. Hot water doesn't change its status or doesn't change the way it is from it was when it's cold to when it's hot. Therefore, there's no bishlakum. Klayot, roasted items, do not have any change in the item. It's just the item heated up or dried out. And therefore, it's not a problem of bishlakum. And beitzat skluya, a roasted egg or a cooked egg is problematic, which would go against the position of Bar Kapara and Chizkia. They don't have to worry about it. They're Tanaim, so they can argue on a Braita. It's not a definitive proof against them because we can say that it's a Machloket Tanaim. Shemen, which we've discussed extensively before, was wiped out by the Beit Din Rebbe Yehuda Nisiya. And Tanya, he Hamatalia, he Pashlaya, he Shiato. So then the Gemara here, in trying to explain what this Matalia is, so it brings another braita that says Matalia is synonymous with Pashlaya, which is a type of bean. Hishiata, which is, we're going to see in a second, the Egyptian bean. My Shiata, what is this Shiata? So you see this problem that I've discussed many times, that the Gemara is seeing something in it. And the Tanaic work is using a Hebrew name or a name that's familiar in Eretz Yisrael. And here in Bavel, they're trying to figure out what it is. So they bring another braita that gives the other possible names for this item, but then they still don't know. And now they're trying to query as to what this shiata is. So Amar Rabbi Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Harbein Shnin, it's already for 40 years, and Nafigai Uvdam in Mitzrayim. They've been importing this Egyptian bean from Egypt. It's already 40 years have gone by. Rabba Bar Barchana Didei Amar, Rabbi Barchana himself says, Hashitin Shnin the Nafik, Hai Uvdam in Mitzrayim. It's already 60 years that they've been importing this bean from Mitzrayim. Below Pligay, and they're not arguing. Mar Bishnei, Mar Bishnei. Each one of them in their time. Rabbi Yochanan's obviously older than Rabba Bar Barchana. So when Rabbi Yochanan said it, it was already being imported for 40 years. By the time Rabbi Barchana says it himself, it's already 60 years. I mean, that's 20 years later, and Rabbi Barchana says that they've been doing this for 60 years. They're not arguing about when it started, but they both say that it was imported from Egypt, and these were these Egyptian beans. Mark continues and says, Hey Chavdu, what do they used to do, or how do they make this shiota? Maite bizra de karpasa, they bring the seeds of karpas, whether it's celery or parsley, ubizra de kidna, and seeds of flax, ubrizra de shavliuta. Look at Rashi, he says that it's fenugreek. So these are seeds of fenugreek. The taruluhu ba'dea dodi, bipshure. You soak them together in warm water. Bishavkule ad the mikbel. And you leave them in there until they begin to sprout. Umaiti chatzve chadate. Then you bring a new earthenware utensil. Maluluhu mayo. And you fill it up with water. Bitarubuhu gargishta. And then you place in there a soak in there red clay. Umadbikin be. And then you plant these sprouted seeds into this red clay that has now been moistened in there. The island of Beibani. And then you go into the bathhouse. At the Nafku, by the time you come out of the bathhouse, once you planted it on the way in, Melav Lave, they blossom. The Achle Minayu. And then you can eat from them. The Kaire. And then they cool the person's body. Mibinta de Reshayu, from the hair on his head. Atufra de Grayu, to the nails on his feet, meaning from head to toe. It cools them off. Amar Ravashi, Amarli Rabbi Chanina. I have from Rabbi Chanina about this concoction or this thing that they did. Milin. It's a myth. It doesn't really happen. Nothing blossoms in an hour. And all of this is a huge myth that is being told over. It never really happened and doesn't happen. Bamila Bimilin. And some say the Masor wasn't that it was a myth, but rather the way it happened was through sorcery. That this can't really happen in reality. And therefore the only way this could happen was through sorcery, and it was sorcery that produced this item that they were importing from Egypt, whatever this product was. And what we learned from this is that if the non-Jew soaks the item in warm water or even in hot water, that does not make it into bishul akum, and it's mutar. Because seemingly these things are eaten even in their raw state. Tarabanan, kuspan, which is, as Rashi notes over here, is the remains of the dates after they've been pressed, or the date husks that are left over after the pressing. Shalovdei kochamim. They are a non-Jew's date husks. Shehuchmu chamim biyoreh gedola. If he puts them into a large vat and then cooks them up, then that's problematic. He's cooking them up in order to make it into date beer. Masur. That's problem. But yoreh ktana, if he puts it into a small cauldron, a small pot, mutar. Vezehi yoreh ktana. And what's considered to be a small pot? Amaravyanai kosh ein sipor dror yocholi kanes betocha. It's anything that a young free bird, which is usually associated with the swallow, can't be put into the item. Delma ademuye ademua vailuha. Who says they have to put the item in whole? They can cut it up into its component parts and stick it into the pot. So what we're worried about here in terms of the bishul akum is not the date husks themselves and the cooking of the date husks, because that in itself is not problematic. The date husks can be cooked and it wouldn't be a problem bishul akum. What we're worried about is the fact that he's going to put in non-kosher items into the mix or into the brew of the beer. So if he uses a large cauldron, he has open top, he can put anything he wants in there, that's problematic. So what the Gemara said is that it's a smaller cauldron or pot where he can't put something in it, that's okay. So the Gemara said the standard seemed to be the size of a tzipor drawer, which if it can't fit in there, that's the smallest item that is non-kosher animal that you could be putting in there. And if you can't fit it in there, that's fine. The Gemara says, who says he has to put it in whole? He can slice it up to pieces and stick it in there. Hella, koshein rosh tzipor dror yocholi kanes betocha. The top is so narrow that you can't even fit in the head of this bird, which is the smallest part of this bird. Can't be fit into that opening. Then you don't have to worry about davar tameh being placed into the shechar, and that this pot or this item is being solely used for making of the date beer and not mixing non-kosher items in it, which has nafkamino talocha, where you have certain items that are only used and only cooked in that manner, and they would not be considered to be non-kosher. And the Rav Yosef in the Tshuva mentions about on the airplanes,
the coffee that's served on airplanes. When they put the coffee pots on the coffee heaters, the coffee that's cooked up there is done in a way where nobody would use those utensils for anything besides coffee, because it would ruin the flavor of the coffee. And the coffee itself is just pure coffee. If you put those two items together, then you have a heter to drink the coffee on the plane and not worry about bishul akum with regards to the coffee. Now, one of those items has changed. It's still true that when they use those coffee pots, they only use it for coffee, and therefore it would not be a problem bishul akum from that reason. But the other reason's changed a little bit, which is that today there's not only plain coffee, there are all these fancy coffees that they make these days, and the fancier flavored coffees can have non-kosher ingredients in them, and that could present a problem in terms of the stam coffee. You have to know, many airlines are no frills, and they don't serve these fancy coffees in that coffee, and therefore it won't be a problem. But if they do serve the fancy coffees, then you have to start to worry about whether they're non-kosher items that are also being made in the same coffee pot. V'atanya, don't we have a braita that says, achat yurek dola, v'achat yurek tana? Doesn't matter if it's a big pot or a small pot, mutar, lo kasha. Haga mandamar noten tam nifkam asur, haga mandamar noten tam nifkam mutar. That is based on a machloket that we're going to get into later in the Masechta, as to whether when a flavor is negatively affecting the item that it's flavoring, is that considered to be a problem or not? If it's notein tam l'shevach, if the item adds additional flavor which is positively enhancing the item, there it's clearly problematic, because then the isur is now permeating the item that you're cooking, and that will be problematic in terms of eating it, because it's notein tam l'shevach. The other item, it's notein tam l'fgam, which means that the flavor is no longer beneficial or improving the item. Is that considered to be a problem? Generally, we believe that notein tam l'fgam starts after 24 hours. After a 24-hour period, whatever flavor is embedded in the pots, that flavor already is deteriorated, and then any flavor imparted at that point in time is not considered to be flavor the shevach, but rather flavor l'fgam. The question is, notein tam l'fgam, if you give off this negative flavor, is that mutar or asur? So what we're saying over here is that this Tana believes that notein tam l'fgam is mutar, and that's why he lets you use any of the pots of the non-Jew, whether a big pot or a small pot, because even if they were used to cook isur, now the isur is already embedded in the walls, and the flavor that would be imparted is already lifgam, is a negative flavor, and therefore it's not problematic, as opposed to the first Tana, who thinks that notein lifgam is asur. Therefore he said that the greater cauldron is problematic, whereas the small cauldron is not problematic. A big cauldron is problematic because you can get non-kosher items in there, and therefore there's Easter embedded in it. The small cauldron is so small that you can't get in non-kosher items. Even the head of this swallow, you can't get in there. So you can't get non-kosher items, so it's not a problem of Easter. You can't get Easter into the pot, then there's no Easter that's being imparted. The second Tana says, even if there's Easter being imparted, it's already Easter that's lifgam, and therefore it's not problematic. This leads both Rashi over here and the Balei Tosfot to stay that stam klei ovdei kochavim, the default status of a kli of an ovdei kochavim, is enu ben yoma. It's already been 24 hours since he's last used it. Therefore, we assume it's notein tam lifgam. That's the underlying assumption of the Gemara here, as well as the Tana in the Braita. That is that it's always considered to be enu ben yoma, and it's notein tam lifgam when you are taking a stam pot of a goy. The Balei Tosafot say, even if we have a sfeik as to whether he's cooked in it in the last 24 hours, you have a sfeik sfeika. There's one sfeik that he used the pot in the last 24 hours. And if he did use the pot in the last 24 hours, who says he cooked isur in that part of time or in that 24-hour period? So that sfeik sfeika makes it that we don't worry about the pots of the Oved Kochavim giving off isur the shevach. We assume that they are tam lifgam. That's not only true by the pots of a goy, it's true of the pots of a Jew. We don't know differently, or we don't know any information. We assume that they're enu ben yoman. We assume that they are older or aged more than 24 hours. And therefore, they're notein tam lifgam, and that gives you dispensations in certain cases where enu ben yomo is much more makil than ben yomo, where the flavor is still intact. That can halachically affect the situation when we're coming or dealing with pots where a person doesn't know when the last time that pot was used. Amar Rav Sheshet, hai mishcha shlika, this oil that is cooked up, darmai of non-Jews, asur, is problematic. Amar Rav Safra, darmai nechush. What do you have to worry about here with oil? Imishum eruve, if you're worried about them mixing in wine with it, misrasari, it would cause it to go rancid or putrid because the wine deteriorates where the oil does not. Imishum bishle ovdei kochavim, if you're worried about bishul akom, nechal kamoshu chai, it's eaten raw. oil can be used even in its raw state. It doesn't need to be cooked to be used. Imishum ge'ule ovdei kochavim. If you're worried about flavoring, that it's cooked in the pot of the non-Jew, and therefore now there's flavor that's being imparted from Isur, notein tam nifgamo. The pots of the Ovdei Kochavim are considered to be Enu ben Yoman, and the flavor that's being imparted is lifgam, or mutar, and therefore it should be mutar. So he disagrees with that psak and says that the oil should be totally fine. Bamine Rabbi Asi, Hani Ahine, Shlike Darmai, these dates that are being cooked up that belong to the non-Jew. My, what's the din? Chuhiai Loti Bailach. Sweet dates, you don't have to ask any questions about. Devadai Shoru. They're definitely mutar because you can eat them in their state that they are now. Cooking the dates doesn't make any change to make them edible. It's nechal kashu chai, and therefore there's no issue of bishlakum over here. Mirire, bitter dates, loti bailach devadai asire. There it's definitely asur, it's definitely bishul avei kochavim, because they cannot be eaten in the state that they're in. They're inedible in their bitter state. They must be cooked in order to sweeten them and make them edible. So there the cooking is taking them from the inedible to the edible state. That makes it that it's asur because of bishlakum. Kidi bailach mitzaye. Question is about in between, dates that are not super sweet, but dates that are also not bitter. My, what's the din? Amar lo, mighty bailuchu, the rabbi asar. Why are you even asking me the question? You know that my rabbi says it's asur. Umanu, and who is that? Levi. Levi was his rabbi, and Levi said that these dates are definitely problematic if they come from a non-Jew and then cooked by a non-Jew. Shtita'a, which is some sort of dish which is made from roasted kernels that were milled into flour, and then it's made out of different types of flour. Some of the flours are sweeter flours, and other flours are not so sweet. Depending on the sweetness of the item, they add in other ingredients to mitigate that flavor. Rav Shari, Rav said it was mutar. Avua de Shmuel v'Levi, the father of Shmuel and Levi, Asri, said it was asur. V'chite v'sari kulei amelo plige de Shari. Everybody agrees if it's wheat or barley that was used in the processing over here, then it is mutar. Because there's no necessity to offset the sweetness of the flour, because the wheat and barley flour by nature is not very sweet. So you're not going to have any additives in there. That's why it's not a problem. When we're talking about this lentil flour that has chometz, that has vinegar added into it, everybody agrees that that's a sur, because the vinegar could derive from stam yenam. Therefore the vinegar is problematic because of stam yenam. And they're definitely going to add in vinegar over here because the lentil flour is much sweeter. To offset that sweetness, they used to put in chometz. They used to put in vinegar, and we know vinegar is a problem of yein akum, or stam yeinam. Ki plige b'tal fechei demaya. The place where they argue is where the flour of the lentils was put into water. Marsar gazrin and ha tuha. Avu and Shmuel and Levi believe that there's a gzera in mayim atu chometz. Marsava lo gazrinan, and Rav believes that there is no such gzera, and that's why it's mutar. Everybody agrees by lentils and water that's asur. Kiplige b'chite v'sari, and they argue about wheat and barley. Marsava gazrinan ha atu ha. Some say where goes there, wheat and barley atu lentils. Marsava lo gazrin, and Rav says Renat goes there for this to this. So Chize and Sari are on their own. And the problem seems to be in this case is because you're adding in chometz, and it's a problem of stam yenam. So in a case where you would add in chometz, that's where we know for sure there is a problem. But in cases where you don't add in chometz, the question is, did they extend the gazera to those other items as well? So Amarav, Tremine Shtita, Shadar Barzilai Agiladi to David. Barzilai Agiladi sent to David. Two types of shtita, dichtiv. When David is running away from Absalom, when he's already gone into Eber Yardin and ends up in a place called Machanaima, over there Barzilai Agiladi supplies David and his men and all the people that are with him with the following items. Mishkav, v'sapot, uchli yotzer, v'chitim, u'seorim, v'kemach, v'kali, ufo, v'adashim, v'kali. So he gave them couches and basins, earthenware utensils, wheat barley, flour, parched grains, which is the first kali, beans, lentils, and again, parched grain. So why is the parched grain mentioned twice in the pasuk? Well, to teach you that he provided him with two different types of this brew or beverage that was the shtita'a, made out of kali, made out of these roasted grains that are then made into flour. So he sent him two types of that, and that's because the word kali is mentioned twice in the pasuk. And here we're also speaking about different types of this shtita'a. It can be made out of wheat, barley, lentils, all types of mixtures to make this brew or beverage.
And nowadays, they carry out basketfuls of this stuff into the marketplaces of Narda. But later, Chayish, Lahad, Avu, Adishmo, Levi. Nobody worries about the Pesach of Avu, Adishmo, and Levi, who say that it's a sore. Meaning that the Locha is like Rav, who is Matir, and therefore people are selling them and buying them without any consideration of it being a problem of Vishalakum or a problem of Chometz or Stam Yenam being added into these products. All right, we're going to stop here about the two dots on the bottom of Lamed Chedem Adbet.